On April 19, 2013, during a custody dispute with her ex-husband, Sandra Grazzini-Rucchi abducted her own daughters. 944 days later, they were located on November 18 of 2015, living on a ranch in northern Minnesota. Four separate people ended up receiving criminal charges in the case, including the girl's own mother. In September of 2018, Michael Broadcorb and Allison Mann announced that they would be releasing the book titled The Girls Are Gone. During the past 2 years, the authors, a paralegal for the father's attorney, and a writer for the Minnesota News Center that was reporting on the case during trial, they've uncovered new details about the disappearance of Samantha and Gianna, and the adults that work together to hide the sisters and the truth from everyone. They conducted many interviews to gather the complete story, including members of the Rucchi family. And that included the daughters, Samantha and Gianna. The book covers key events that unfolded during the criminal trials. Trials including those involved in the heinous crime, and those who helped in a conspiracy to keep the public and investigators from locating them, many pleading guilty or being convicted of criminal offenses for their own involvement. The book also discusses the connection between Michelle McDonald, who was recently a candidate for the Minnesota Supreme Court but lost that elected position only yesterday in the midterm election for the third time, and two people convicted for their roles in the disappearance of the Rucchi sisters, Sandra Grazzini-Rucchi, their own mother, and Dee Dee Uvalde. McDonald was labeled a person of interest by the Lakeville Police Department in the disappearance of Samantha and Gianna, but she did not cooperate in the investigation. The book, The Girls Are Gone, was published on October 23rd by Wise Inc. Creative Publishing. I was fortunate enough to discuss the book and this case with Allison and Michael, and you may notice I was slightly starstruck. Not because of any reason you may imagine, but because I had just read one of the most well-presented and deeply researched true crime books I have ever read. Listeners, we all love true crime, but I know our community is very special because we tend to be drawn to the cases that have compelling human stories behind the crimes. You will not be disappointed with The Girls Are Gone. In fact, when I was ready to flip through and familiarize myself with the general outlay of the book before reading it the next day, I ended up going to bed at 3 a.m. I was just drawn into the story and the detailed information that I lost track of all time. I will include links in the notes to their amazing website, which is a terrific companion to the book, as well as links to how and where you can find your own copy. It seems available in multiple formats in all major bookstores and all the online shops. This is a pretty good gift idea for that true crime fan you need to find a gift for, but never quite know what they have or haven't read. Allison Mann and Michael Broadcorb have penciled a truly benchmark true crime book. It has the facts of a deeply researched periodical and the heart of a warm storytelling read. Unfortunately, it's all true. The book is The Girls Are Gone, and I'm talking with them today. So please, don't leave me. I just want to kind of start out congratulating you on the book.
Thank you so much.
It's a really interesting case, too. I did a little bit of background research. To get started, maybe I'll ask you to just quickly go through how you got involved in this case.
My involvement started first in 2011 when the father, David Rucchi, came into the law firm where I work as a paralegal to get assistance from attorney Lisa Elliott on this divorce that he found himself suddenly in. So I worked as a paralegal with the family from that time all the way through and continue to even today. And it was through my work as a paralegal and being at the criminal trial of the girl's mother that I ended up meeting Michael. And I'll let him tell you about how he got involved and ended up with the criminal trial as well.
At the time, I first learned about this case in April of 2015. I was writing at the time, I was doing some freelance work for a media outlet in Minnesota called the Star Tribune. And I was covering mostly political stories. A reporter for the Star Tribune had written about this story about the disappearance of two missing kids involved in this contentious divorce proceeding. And the attorney for the mother had been previously, and is still today, a candidate for office. She's been a candidate for the Minnesota Supreme Court in Minnesota multiple times. So I was familiar with the mother's attorney through my work in covering politics. And so after the Star Tribune ran a story in April of 2015, kind of around the two-year anniversary of the disappearance of the kids, I started then reporting on the case through some sources that I have. And then I eventually met Allison at the criminal trial for the mother, which was in the summer of 2016.
You know what? You could have probably wrote an entire book about Michelle McDonald.
We could have. I mean, she, and one of the decisions that Allison and I came to near the end of the book is, you know, Allison and I approached this from the perspective of this is a story about missing kids. And we wanted to keep the focus as much as we could on disappearance of these kids. You know, Allison and I have talked about doing stand-up story down the road on Michelle. She is such a central figure in this, but she also distracts greatly from the story about these kids. And she's a bit player in that in some aspects, in some parts of the story. She's a major player. So we made a collective editorial decision to kind of diminish the significance of how much we talked about Michelle, because it would distract from telling, I think, a more detailed story about how these kids disappeared, the search for them, how they were found, and how the adults that were involved were prosecuted for their involvement.
You know, that was probably a tough decision to make in terms of what to include in the book and what to take out. But just because it's kind of fresh in my mind, I can definitely say for true crime books, this is probably one of the best written ones I've ever read.
Oh my goodness.
Saying it to butter you up. One of the things that can happen with true crime books is they sort of cover the surface material and then maybe a little bit deeper, but they try to stick to the thing that a lot of people will look for in true crime. Some of the more gory, scary stuff. But this book is so well researched and it gives you everything you want when you want to really envelope yourself into this story. And the research is almost unbelievable, incredible. You really do feel after you're done reading the book, you have a pretty good handle on everything that happened during the case. So I really have to commend you on that. It's clearly something that you both have put a lot of energy and work into.
So. Thank you so much. That is such a compliment.
So if we can talk a little bit about this case, you know, in early 1991, the way I understand it is that that's when Sandra and David got married. And so they were married for quite a while before any indications started coming about a rift in the relationship, as far as I can see. I don't know if you can elaborate on that a little bit for me.
I maybe can. And I also think it's interesting that they were together dating for, you know, quite a while before they actually got married. I want to say 5 years. They didn't have children right away either. So they really took things slow. And actually, in some of the reports from some of the child advocates and the people that were evaluating the family, they noted those things, that this family came together very purposefully. They were together a long time. They had 5 children together. And things were good for a long time. And what happened? Everyone always wants to know what happened. And if you look into that chapter where we talk about Sandra's family, her family, the Grazini family, and them being such a wealthy family and all of the problems that came along with the estate and the fighting and things that happened when her parents passed away, that kind of was the beginning of the end for Sandra herself and when things really started to take a turn.
Yeah, one thing that definitely jumped out for me when I was reading the book was that as soon as there was any indication that there was money missing out of the trust funds when someone started looking into the money for the trust funds. Mm-hmm. That seemed to be a pretty big tug on the rest of the yarn that would pull through the entire story.
That's an incredibly astute observation and a very important point that we've tried to make throughout this. You know, Allison and I had a speaking engagement today, and someone was asking us, you know, what was the trigger for this? What was the motivation behind this? And it was money. I mean, we believe that money played a huge role in the motivation behind Sandra and the other people that were involved in this. And, you know, the importance of the children, sadly, became a secondary issue when it came down to a discussion about money. And so that's a great point you made about the trust pulling of the yarn. That's a very astute point, and it's something that this book could have been an expose on forensic auditing and other stuff. Sandra came from an incredibly wealthy family with a trust in upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars. And so money was a huge role in this. Unfortunately, it was.
She's compelling in the sense that, I mean, she came from wealth. It appears he didn't, but her relationship with money became very strange. I mean, she was moving money around a lot to make it appear that money was in places where it wasn't. And then after the divorce, which was, you know, as you kind of discovered going through the book, the divorce was more about money in the beginning. It was just supposed to be on paper. And it certainly became much more convoluted than that. The divorce wasn't just about on paper to protect his business and his family's business. It became sort of more a thing about her desire for more money or something. I don't know. It's really difficult to.
You're right.
Yeah.
And that's just playing to his wantonness to protect his family and what they had. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it easy for her to convince him to go along with that plan.
Yeah, they had been married for so long that when he said, I just signed the documents. I mean, why wouldn't mm-hmm. he? I definitely felt that made a lot of sense to me that after being married that long and with five children, why would he go through the documents and double check everything?
You're absolutely right.
I could easily fall into that hole. So
I think many of us could.
And there were, you know, and there was discussion, you know, in the book about where Sandra testified. She also that she just signed things too. So I understand how some people could be critical of that, but also the reality is that in a marriage, you just sign some things when you're in a relationship and others, sometimes you just sign things and you don't look at them as closely as you should. There's stories in the book about both Sandra acknowledging that and also David too.
You know, over 10 years, like the roots are very deep. I can understand on the surface that divorce became kind of the fulcrum because it was when the split was happening that Samantha and Gianna disappeared.
Yep. It was 2013 when the girls disappeared, April 19th of 2013.
So it was during a custody dispute. Yep. I'm wondering if that custody dispute seems kind of like by design. I mean, it would appear Sandra designed that custody dispute. I'm not 100% clear on if she had already planned that the two girls would go missing earlier on, or if it was just something that naturally...
Well, I can speak a little bit to that, you know, just in talking with the children and without giving away the whole book. This opportunity presented itself two times, and it was in September of 2012, the first time that the kids had the opportunity to run away, and they all did, and that was at their mother's instruction, and that's detailed in the book. We write kind of extensively because we had the opportunity to speak with the kids about that and how Sandra was able to orchestrate that and tell the children to do just that. On the other hand, on the April 19th, 2013 date, Samantha and Gianna said that it was not their mother's idea for them to go. The kids were in a situation where they didn't know what was going to happen next. And they were, you know, they just didn't know. And they knew that every day there was a possibility that someone else was going to tell them where to go, how to live, and who to be with. And they were, quite frankly, tired of it because there wasn't enough focus on the kids and what was happening with them.
Yeah, Allison makes a fantastic point related to that. I mean, in speaking with the kids, the sense of uncertainty that they had, the repeated uncertainty, the what was going to be happening a month from now or a week from now, just, I think, tugged at these kids repeatedly. And this was ultimately, I think, for lack of a better phrase, a crime of opportunity. this is an opportunity came available to Sandra. And it's pretty clear, some ways Sandra did a really good job of covering her tracks, and in other ways, she did a very poor job of covering her tracks. So it took a network of people in which to aid Sandra in doing this. And I think that the fact that there's that number of people that were ultimately involved, both in the physical hiding of the kids and keeping them away from their father, plus then others that kind of were involved in kind of mucking up the system and making the investigation and other things complicated, I think it shows how little planning Sandra did initially, but how it just metastasized into this absolutely robust conspiracy to hide not only the children, but the truth. And ultimately, it's a little bit of a play on words in the subtitle of the book. It was the combination of two things that these adults were trying to hide. They were trying to hide the children and the truth about the circumstances by which these kids disappeared. And that took more of an elaborate plan than I think Sandra was capable of doing.
It was very compelling to me how many people were involved.
We're talking about the adults with families and kids. You know, one of the people that helped was involved in hiding the kids was a mandated reporter. She worked for a school district and had an obligation under the law to report things. One person who is connected to this, who's involved in conspiracy related, this is a licensed in marriage family therapist in the state of Minnesota. We have attorneys that are connected to this. And I don't mean to be stereotypical here in any type of way, but these are not what I would venture to say your average criminals or your average people that help criminals or people who are friends with criminals. These are people that have, some of them have advanced degrees, some of them have good jobs, some of them have relationships with regulatory agencies in the state of Minnesota, that all had an obligation at some point to speak up and do the right thing, and they failed to do it for what Allison and I present as a hypothesis is because of their own kind of conspiracy theory and their own personal agendas against the court system.
It made the book so compelling. The first night that I was going to just flip through it and become accustomed to it, I went to bed at 3 a.m.
Wow.
It was just one of these things that you just get into it and you're just completely entranced. A lot of people that listen to my podcast, the people who do are very, very engaged. And so I think they're going to really enjoy this book because it gives you all that stuff you want. There's a lot of information. So it's kind of a treat. It is a tragic story, but it is a really good book. So I was kind of shocked to discover things like, you know, she was in court during the process of the divorce, saying that she was almost destitute, having to sell her own things to make enough money to just pay the bills.
Sandra was desperate. And the only thing she was desperate for was her money, which is, to me, unbelievable. As a mother, as a parent, I find it just unbelievable that something could matter more to her than her children. But it certainly became clear time and time again that children were not her first thought. They just weren't. Mm-hmm. It was obviously the money, and she was doing everything that she could to make sure that she appeared to be homeless. And she always says her kind of quote is homeless, penniless, destitute. Still to this day, we struggle at my office with battling that exact issue because she puts herself out there to be homeless and she gets assistance from the courts. And it's just simply not true. She does have a home. She is not homeless. She is not penniless.
And if I can add a point to that, Allison, and this was shocking to me, Allison, of the two of us, Allison's the legal expert. She's a paralegal and she understands this. It is continually astounding to me the level at which Sandra and her supporters can con the system, con the judiciary in Minnesota, in the United States, where they are continually benefiting from having free court service, free filing fees and other things. Let me be very honest with you. Allison and I have met many people in the family court system that have had difficulties and continue to have difficulties in the family court system who are in legitimate need to having their filing fees paid and their court services paid. They are struggling to make ends meet. Sandra is not one of those people. And she used the system. She has what is so surprising to me is, aside from every other aspect of her life where Sandra can succeed, if there's one thing she is very successful at, is in trying to find a way to game the system and to use the system to her advantage. And this is someone who you know, while her kids were missing, and when she was telling the court that she was penniless, homeless, and destitute and didn't have anything, she was gambling on cruise ships. She was taking a kind of exotic vacations all across the world. And it's con, independence, if we can for just a second, set aside the emotional tug that that people have, I think, towards children and the support they have, just for a second, and think about the level of con that she's told on the legal community and how she gets her legal fees paid for and her court fees paid for, and she maneuvers inside the system. It is something she is still perpetrating yet today. Thankfully, the kids are doing better, family's doing better, and not to ruin the ending, but the act that Sandra is doing today, the con that she's still perpetrating, is a con on the court system, and she is such a drain on the court system.
In reading the book, you can actually feel a sense of anger coming through.
Well, no, which, I mean, it's appalling to think. Absolutely.
One of the things that I struggled with a little bit, because I don't know a lot about the legal side of things, was that in her charging, I'm not clear on what deprivation of parental rights means. I believe she was found guilty of 6 counts.
She was. So it's deprivation of parental or custodial rights. No.
Okay.
There were different time frames involved in this crime because it was a long-standing perpetual crime. It went on for 944 days. So when the girls initially were taken, it was their aunt, David's sister, Tammy Love, who had custody of those girls and the children. So she was a victim. She was deprived of her custodial rights of both Samantha and Gianna. Then there was David as the father, who after the time that he was given custody, awarded custody of his children, which was after the girls had been taken, he became a victim as well, because then his custodial rights or his parental rights were being taken from him at that time. The additional charges come from the amount of time that the girls were gone and the various things that happened. They can build onto the initial crime. There were other people involved, and there's aiding and abetting would be, you know, a charge on causing the minor children to run. So there would be one for each of the girls for that. Now, if you read in the book, the jury did not find Sandra guilty of causing her children to run. And the jury made it very clear in their verdict when they found her not guilty on those charges, on those counts, that they wanted Samantha and Gianna to understand that they were not at fault. The jury did not feel that they had any role in what happened to them.
And then it also seemed that Deirdre was sentenced similarly. Not her sentencing, but her charges. She was also charged with deprivation of parental rights?
Correct.
Is that correct?
She assisted Sandra. Mm-hmm. She lined up the connection to the White Horse Ranch and to the Darlings. She helped facilitate the girls going there. She had the girls and Sandra at her home in St. Cloud, Minnesota for 2 nights right after they left here. So they left on April 19th, and they spent the night of the 19th and the 20th at Dee Dee Evable's home in St. Cloud. And Dee Dee drove the vehicle with Sandra and Samantha and Gianna up to the White Horse Ranch and left them there and brought Sandra back to St. Cloud. Dee Dee was guilty taking them there, of knowing they were there, of perpetuating that crime over and over every time she was asked and continued to lie about her involvement in the molestation of the girls.
Her sentencing seemed rather light to me.
In Minnesota, the crime of deprivation of parental rights is a presumptive probationary sentence. So typically, people don't do jail time for this crime. And that's something we speak to in the book. There needs to be some changes made in some of the laws and the statutes regarding that. It's not a high enough penalty. There should be a bigger deterrent if a mom or a dad is considering taking their children in the middle of a custody dispute because they simply just don't want that other parent to have access to the kids. There needs to be something to deter them. And a presumptive probationary sentence just isn't enough.
Yeah, I was very shocked for considering her involvement in such a serious event. I didn't really reconcile the amount of time that she spent in prison. It was less than 200 days. I think it was 160 or something like that.
For Didi Evable, correct.
For Doug and Gina Dolan, they only spent, and they had the kids under their, I would say, jurisdiction, under their control, of 942 out of the 944 days. Doug and Gina Dolan spent approximately 21 days in jail. They spent 21 days in jail at a jail facility where they were granted work release during the day. They were allowed to go back to their farm, their ranch, and work during the day. They could eat lunch at their kitchen table, and then they would drive back to the jail facility in a nearby county. It was a co-ed jail facility. They could rent movies. They could sit in the commons area. It was a nice jail facility. And for 21 days, that's where they stayed, and that was their time. It was a miscarriage of justice in terms of the sentencing is an understatement, and it's an affront to justice. And hopefully, our hope is by doing interviews like this and others can lead to some much-needed reforms inside the criminal justice system.
Absolutely. 3 weeks is ridiculous. Can I ask both of you what it was like when you did finally speak to the children? That must have been a little bit of an intimidating situation.
Our number one concern in talking to the Ruckey children was to make sure that the Ruckey children were okay. We wanted to give each of them the level of privacy that they desired in terms of talking to us on the record. It was important for us to just take care of them, to treat them as we would want or we would treat our own children. In that manner, we were very, very cautious. For me personally, I had met Nico Ruckey a long time prior to the first time I interviewed him. I had very briefly met Samantha. Now, I can tell you that watching Michael and Samantha meet for the first time was one of the most powerful things that has happened to me, and certainly the most in this entire process of the case and writing the book. It was a tremendous moment. To watch someone who helped find a child, see that child in a room up close and personal for the first time, and for that child, who, she wasn't a child anymore, but in our eyes she was. She was only, I think, 19 when we interviewed her, to see her, to see him, and kind of the way she looked at him, and just that moment of kind of relief, I think, for both of them, finally meeting each other. It was emotional. It was emotional for them, and it was an emotional experience.
I know your website is really impressive. I got a chance to look at it earlier, and there's a lot of information on the website as well. But I'm wondering, how far into your experiences with the case did you decide that you were both going to write the book?
I had set up the website prior to this, right before the start of the criminal trial. And, in retrospect, I was, started the kind of the framework of the ultimate book. The book came together the moment I had the opportunity to meet Allison. I mean, she brought such a focus and a direction to this book and a discipline to this that made this book happen. And her knowledge of the court system, her knowledge of this case, and even her, as she kind of described, light kind of relationship with the children, that was an incredibly important component in getting the kids to feel comfortable with us. First and foremost, Allison had a professional relationship with the family related to her work, but Allison is also a woman. And we were dealing with, in some of these cases, minor children, teenage girls, young women. It provided a good dynamic to have all of us talking together. Allison is a mother. I'm a father. One of the things, kind of looking at the need to talk to the kids, one of the decisions we tried to make is, first and foremost, how much of speaking with the kids will we need to do to tell this story? And the reality is that there are some aspects of this story that can only be told from the eyes of the children. And we try to keep our questions as much as we could focus on those components, kind of the do no harm approach. We conducted these interviews as if we were conducting them, and we channeled them in a way in which we were talking to our own children. We wanted to make sure that they understood that they were comfortable, they were in a safe environment, they were in an environment where they had a voice. And even though that there was an age difference and stuff, it was a very mutually respectful conversation. And every interview that we've ended with discussion on what we discussed. And you know, every interview that we started the next time was a discussion about what we discussed. Is everything okay? Any questions? And Allison and I developed, I think, a tremendous amount of respect for the kids. And one of the things that we also wanted to do is, many people, having read the book, will understand this, is the number of people that kind of took these kids' voice, whether it was in a court proceeding or other thing online. Many adults attempted to be the spokesman for these kids in online stuff and in court petitions. And when Allison and I sat down and spoke to the kids, we treated them as equals, as peer equals, and didn't try to take their voice in terms of being their voice. We wanted them to speak. And to the degree in which they felt comfortable speaking, they spoke. And if they wanted some privacy, we wanted to give that to them. And so, you know, the writing process for us wasn't really complete until we sat down with one of the kids and you know, gave them a copy of the book and let them know it was done, it was out, and they were. It was a very respectful process. But this really came, I would say, and this I'm biased, but I'll say this, that this writing process came together when Allison got involved, and it provided a tremendous amount of much needed focus for this project.
I think you both obviously had a big hand in it, but a pretty interesting relationship that you guys have, that you can sort of both work on this. It is kind of a bit of a monster of a book. It's quite a lot of material. It seems like something that would be difficult to pull off, but you both seem to have a really sort of fluid way, even the way you speak, of just kind of working together. So I'm kind of grateful that it was both of you that wrote this book, because
I will say to you, I couldn't have done this without Allison. And as much as, for lack of a better phrase, I was the professional writer and she was the person who worked in the legal community, Allison brought not only a deep understanding of the law, although she's not a lawyer, which I think is a tremendous asset in this case. She's able to help kind of translate for laymen like me, but also brought a tremendous amount of respect to the story. And aside from photographs and just raw writing talent that just infused this story. Again, I will also say, and I've repeated it before, the fact that we're both parents and we both have our own kids, that was critically important too. This is the type of story that requires a thoughtfulness and a care and a respect of children and the relationships that we're in. And the fact that Allison has a wonderful family and I have a wonderful family, and the fact that we're parents to our separate children had a huge impact on that. And it was really important throughout this.
It really does come through when you're reading the book. It really does, that there is a sensitivity there to the story from all sides, but that there definitely is a special sensitivity to the family. Like I said earlier, it does make me kind of a little warm inside thinking, you know what, the right people wrote this book. This story is told by the right people because the sensitivity is there. So I really enjoyed it.
That's so nice.
Do you mind me asking, once you're done the tour of promotion for this book, what do you see your future involvement? I mean, in this case, how long until you decide, okay, we're going to move on?
That's a great question. You know, one of the things that's going on with this story is it's ongoing. There are elements of this case that are still going on. Although the family is healing and there's matters related to some of the actors involved with this that still continue. Dee Dee Ebbelbold continues to engage in a pattern of harassment against the family. She might be going back to jail on some probation violations related to her repeated harassment of this family. Michelle McDonald was the attorney for Sandra Gruzzini-Rucki, is a candidate for political office, or as a candidate for judge. She's facing a disciplinary hearing related to her ability to keep her law license, all stemming from this case. And all stemming from that. And ultimately, you know, I think Allison and I are committed to seeing this story through the end. I think that we've plowed, I think, some really good, a very, very good work product related to the family. But there might be some aspects related to some of the characters that were involved that might require at least an additional update or a standalone project, which Allison and I are discussing. I would tell you, before Allison has the opportunity to say she wouldn't do it, I would say I would love to write another book with her, if the right subject came along. And so if you could get her to commit on the podcast tonight, that would be great for me. So.
Well, I would definitely beg her to, because, you know, I think there, honestly, there is, in two respects, that makes me kind of giddy. I would love to see that the date or the follow-up, because it would, there is a lot more that, you know, finding the children was just kind of almost the beginning of the story in a way. But also, you had mentioned earlier that, you know, there is some reform needed in the legal response to this. And
there is,
you know, I'm not sure if either one of you is even interested in touching that one, but I mean,
you know, there's a number of things that could be done, things that can be changed based on this story that would help, I think, so many people. One of the most important things is, and I don't know how this translates outside of the United States, but we have the Amber Alert system. That system was not available on the night that Samantha and Gianna went missing because the proper check marks weren't checked on their disappearance. So law enforcement could not issue an Amber Alert. An Amber Alert would have published the information about the girls, their mother, the model of the vehicle, the license plate, all that stuff. That information would have gone to cell phones and computers and billboards and everything across, you know, the metro area where we are here and outstate. And it would have been a tremendous help for law enforcement, but their hands were tied. There was nothing they could do because it was believed that the children were with their mother. And that was a problem. And I know that in some places, other states in our country, there's different levels of these kinds of alerts where they have, I believe it's in Arizona, there is such thing as a silver alert for an elderly person or someone with a memory problem or memory disease, and they issue those. And it's a similar thing where this information gets broadcasted across multiple platforms. Something like that is seemingly simple to implement, but in Minnesota, we don't have that. And I think that would be a great change. As we discussed earlier, I think there's room for change in our laws regarding, you know, deprivation of parental rights, non-custodial abductions and these sorts of things. There's more information that needs to be out there for people and a greater understanding of how this happened. And, you know, that was an important part of why we wrote this book, was to explain how this happened.
Yeah, you know, there is definitely some room in terms not only of like punitive thing for people that are involved in situations like this, but I think even just the preparedness of the people that are in law enforcement to be able to identify, as you said, they think the children are with their mother. So what do you do? Yeah. But the silver alert, I've never heard of. That's really interesting. That's, yeah. I think that's a great idea.
I do too. I think it's tremendous. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time, you guys. Is there anything else that you want to talk about a little bit?
No, I think you've been fantastic. I think we've covered it in length. If you have any more questions, I just want to make sure that people know the book is available in a variety of formats. And people can go to missinginminnesota.com. That's missinginminnesota.com. And they can get the book in a whole variety of formats, e-readers, and a whole host of things. And I would encourage people to do that. Allison and I update a very robust website related to this. And so if people are looking for information outside of the book or updates that have happened since we published the book, that's where they can go, missinginminnesota.com. Aside from buying the book, they can get updates and follow us there.
Yeah, you know what? It's a great website. Again, I'm repeating myself, but the book is brilliant. So I'm going to encourage for sure.
Wow, thank you so much.
No, you're welcome. It's my pleasure reading it. Thank you so much, you guys, for your time. I'm really grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.